Do you have questions about living with diabetes in South Africa? You're in very good company. Turns out we all do. Welcome to South Africans with Diabetes. I'm Bridget McNulty, and today we're going to be answering your questions to help you live a healthy, happy life with diabetes. This podcast is brought to you by Lilly. First, a disclaimer. I am not a medical expert. Please discuss any changes you want to make to your diabetes treatment with your doctor. Today we're talking about something a little sensitive, eating disorders. Please be kind to yourself. If you find any of this triggering, there's no reason to listen further. But it is an important conversation to have. Eating disorders thrive in secrecy, and we want to be able to bring the conversation into the light. We know that depression and anxiety are far more prevalent in people with diabetes, but what about eating disorders? Especially when you're living with type 1 diabetes, you're almost encouraged to have an obsessive relationship with food. We have to count our carbs and plan our meals and inject the right amount of insulin and never leave home without a snack and don't cheat. Even the language around eating is very emotive. The most common eating disorder among people with diabetes is diabulimia. That's when people with type 1 deliberately take less insulin or skip injections so that they can lose weight. An estimated 40% of women with type 1 and 10% of men with type 1 struggle with diabulimia. But even more pervasive is T1DE, which stands for type 1 diabetes and disordered eating. This is a broader term that kind of refers to a general preoccupation with food or shape or weight that's considered to be outside of normal behavior. People with type 1 diabetes are twice as likely to experience disordered eating. We asked our South Africans with diabetes community if they wanted to share their stories, and they did. A lot of people did. I have a bad relationship with food because as diabetics, we've been conditioned into thinking food is the enemy, shared Teresa. After 28 years and weighing 45 kgs, my body just decided, enough, and it stopped me dead in my tracks, causing a breakdown. After a year, I changed my lifestyle, in recovery mentally, picked up 4 kgs, and I see food as my friend, nourishing my body and mind. Marilise is struggling with this at the moment. Mentally struggling with allowing myself to eat as I'm scared my sugar levels might spike or not be in range, she says. Sandra has gone the other way. She says, my brain is in denial. My mind tells me I'm diabetic, but I just eat as a normal human being. No restrictions on anything. It's not nice living with depression too. It's really hard, this journey. Even that phrase, normal human being, breaks my heart a little. And Joanne has another different flavor to share. Not so much an eating disorder, but I suffer from a crippling fear of hypos. So when my sugar is on a downward trend, I always severely overcorrect by stuffing my face, and I usually end up with roller coaster readings for the rest of the day. It makes calorie and portion control impossible. A lot of people agreed with her. Fear of hypos and overcorrecting as a result are clearly a big problem. To help us make sense of eating disorders and diabetes, we've asked registered dietitian and certified intuitive eating counselor, Gail Landau, to speak to us about her experiences with eating disorders and those of us with diabetes. Thanks so much for joining us, Gail.
Thank you for having me. I'm so grateful for this platform and also to those community members who shared their vulnerability by sharing their journey. I think it's so helpful in the recovery process to be able to share our feelings and our experience and relationship with food so that we can actually normalize it and not feel that we have to be ashamed.
Absolutely. And it was so lovely to see, actually, because people were sharing their experiences as a comment on the post, and then a bunch of other people were like liking it and commenting and saying, oh my goodness, I feel the same way, or I've been through this before. And it, as you say, it just normalizes it. So before we dive in, I have to ask, what is an intuitive eating counselor?
Okay, so there's a book called Intuitive Eating, and it was a book written by two American dietitians, Evelyn Tribbley and Elise Resch. Their book is based essentially on 10 core principles that they felt define what an intuitive or a natural eater is, and it is evidence-based as a non-diet approach. And while there is a book and a workbook actually that's been released, just reading a book or a workbook doesn't always afford you the practical skills of teaching or supporting people in practice on how to actually integrate these 10 principles into your everyday life.
And what is intuitive eating? Can you give us a taster?
Yeah.
Obviously not all 10 principles,
yeah,
but just an idea.
So intuitive eating is really a platform or a framework that would allow you to explore and help you restore a healthier relationship with food and your body. And it does this by really focusing more on the behavioral aspects that are guiding or directing our eating, and also putting a bit of context, like not only always focusing on what a person is eating, but rather when, where, how, and what are the barriers to this process of caring for ourselves nutritionally. So while self-care isn't a principle of intuitive eating, it's actually a theme that runs through the book, and it's very rooted in this internal process, kind of learning to trust the internal process to help you make decisions versus an external process, which is what diet mentality or diet culture is all about. So in diet culture, there's always this emphasis of being told what to eat, when to eat, how much to eat. And with intuitive eating, we rely less on those rules and rather make those choices based on what our body is guiding us to do.
Oh, sounds wonderful. And I can already see that it would feed into people with diabetes, because many of us, when we were diagnosed, were told, oh, here's a diabetes diet. This is what you need to follow. And one of the things we say all the time at Sweet Life is there's no such thing as a diabetes diet, and every person is different, and what works for you might not work for someone else. But there is this sense of externally imposed rules because we're living with diabetes, type 1 or type 2. So in your experience, have you had many people coming to you with eating disorders and diabetes?
Unfortunately, yes. And that's just because eating disorders don't discriminate. They can occur in the young. Yeah. They can occur in older people. They can affect people of any gender orientation, any religion, and any race. So unfortunately, yes. Yeah. In my practice, I tend to see adults more. In type 2, I would say I've mainly treated patients with binge eating disorder. And that's actually, binge eating disorder is one of the more prevalent eating disorders in the general population, but certainly in type 2 adults, we see that. And unfortunately, I have treated an adult with type 1 with severe diabulimia. Unfortunately, she passed away. And it was completely devastating for me. And actually, after that, I realized I actually need to upskill my own training, specifically around around, you know, acute cases of eating disorders, because they really require, as much as diabetes, we always talk about a multidisciplinary team supporting an individual. When it comes to eating disorders, beyond your diabetes supporting team, there needs to be close collaboration with a psychiatrist and a psychologist. Yeah. And in that particular case, this individual didn't have adequate support. And that was unfortunately a sad outcome.
We are doing an episode on diabetes and mental health with psychologist Daniel Scher, who's also a type 1. And he was saying that there are a lot of eating disorders that he's seeing in his practice too. Why do you think it's so common? Are we more comfortable talking about it now, or is it just that we're, like, in my head, there's a straight line between, as I said in the intro, like this encouraging us to be a little bit obsessive about food for good control, that feels like it could easily trip over into an unhealthy obsession with food. But is it as obvious as that, or do you think there's more to it?
So, look, I think firstly we need to also recognize that just the prevalence of eating disorders in the general population is around 16% of adults. Amongst adolescents, anything between 8 to 15%. And sadly, it's an older study from 2009, children as young as 5 years of age. So, the problem is that as soon as you've got a co-occurring condition, that's where there's probably a greater possibility of an eating disorder. So, as you mentioned in the intro, the average element of diabetes care involves some type of food rules, and sadly, actually, some of the interventions that are prescribed outside of the diabetes space would be regarded as disordered eating in other communities. So telling somebody to do intermittent fasting, for example, or cut out a food group, those are red flags for the general population where we would say that relationship with food is problematic, or that is actually on the spectrum of disordered eating. So while there are obviously people within the diabetes family network who are going to have a diagnosable eating disorder, I would say the greater percentage of people with diabetes are probably in the space of disordered eating, where they are going on diet and off diet. So I think diabetes itself may predispose, certainly in people with type 1, they might also have other autoimmune conditions together with diabetes, like celiac disease, which may bring on further restriction over and above being careful about the volume of carbohydrate at a meal. And as you mentioned earlier, the prevalence of anxiety and depression is already there. So now what happens is we bring on all these food rules, and we know that dieting or diet culture and diet mentality and being on a restrictive diet unfortunately sets us up for failure, because it actually causes us to be anxious around our eating, as the one member shared. You know, the fear of a hypo, the fear of going high makes us less trusting of our body in the moment, and we either under-respond or overreact. And so I think that's a factor. And I think, unfortunately, weight stigma is another factor that we need to address. So weight stigma is when we hold negative attitudes towards people in larger bodies, and certainly in the diabetes space, there's a really big message that being fat is the worst possible outcome, and fear fat and fearing a bigger body. And eating disorders don't discriminate. They occur in all sizes of bodies. And we know that weight stigma, or anybody who has experienced judgment or shame because of how their body looks, and over time, that message gets very, very much internalized deep in your psyche. And so even though you're no longer hearing a mean doctor or counselor or whoever it was say a disparaging comment, the internalized shame sits deep within you. And then it actually interferes with your relationship with food.
Absolutely. And when I think of anything to do with diabetes, the message of moderation is not often preached.
Yeah.
What I find missing, and what we try to say at Sweet Life, but we're not registered dietitians, we don't give specific advice, but we say listen to your body and do what you feel is right for you, and everyone is different. But we also in general just preach like a moderate way of eating and a sustainable way of eating. Because I think that's what you're saying here too, is the yo-yoing of going on and off diets is exhausting. It takes up a lot of space. It probably leads to burnout, and it's really bad for your body. Mm. Whereas if you can, the joy of being able to test, particularly for those of us with type 1, and if we're lucky enough to have like a flash glucose monitor or a CGM, is that you can eat something and say, oh, that's interesting. Look at what this food does to me. And oh, gosh, I really can't be eating that in that portion, because look at what my blood sugar did. Or if I'm going to do that, I need to inject more. But it's not often that we approach food in such a, I almost want to say like a light-hearted, curious way. And so that's also why I think it's so important for us to have these conversations, is like, what a relief to hear that most probably, most of us with diabetes have some version of disordered eating. And it probably wasn't consciously adopted. There was no point at which I was like, I'm going to think about food more than anyone else I know. It's just part of the parcel. So knowing that, what do we do about it? I'd love to know what we do about it if there's just a gentle version of disordered eating, and then how to spot the warning signs if it could be something more serious.
Yeah, so I think that's a great question. So I think in terms of the way we think about food in the first place, is instead of labeling it allowed or not allowed, let's rather
or cheat food.
Yeah, exactly. Or clean eating. You know, the only thing about the challenges here is that over and above the information overload that you might receive just from the diabetes care, we're still living in a very weight centric society, which is very much promoting that how you look trumps how you feel.
determines your worth.
Or as you said, this hyper-focus on numbers and vigilant monitoring. So again, with regard to monitoring, I would say let's monitor with meaning. Let's try to be curious about this. And instead of labeling it good or bad, allowed or not allowed, how does this food actually feel in my body? Do I feel energized when I eat it? Do I feel satisfied when I eat it? Does it leave a good mouthfeel? And why that is important is that it's going to guide you whether or not you feel that this is a food that I would like to include in my diet more often. Mm. So I think where it becomes problematic in this gray space of disordered eating, if you've got more food rules governing your food choice, if you're approaching a meal and saying, I should eat this, I have to eat that, or else, you are going to be less likely to be able to respond to how your body is feeling, because you're more focused on how this is going to look in terms of the numbers, and you are forgetting whether or not this actually feels good in my body. So the more food rules you have, the harder it is to trust your body. I would say a warning sign or a worrisome thing and is if food thought is occupying your thoughts. You know, if you think about how much of your day is spent worrying about food or thinking about food, you know, we do need to have some awareness in terms of nutrition and self-care. But if outside of your regular meals and snacks, you're constantly thinking about what to eat, planning meals or whatever, that is cause for concern. Some of the other warning signs where we are shifting more towards, the eating disorder, and an eating disorder can have different presentations. There are different types of eating disorders. So you have anorexia nervosa, which can actually occur in any size body. It's not only, we don't only look for anorexia nervosa in someone in a small frame. It could be bulimia. So bulimia is an element of, can be a person who has tendency for severe restriction and then binging and then a need to purge or vomit or get rid of those goods. So diabulimia is actually a form of that, and people abuse their insulin by under-injecting in order to run their sugars high and so that they will lose weight. So I guess a warning sign would be an unexplained increase in A1C levels. Or repeated episodes of DKA, I'm saying in a type 1. I would say other warning signs is if there's a lot of over-concern around how you look, about body size and shape. Again, another form of bulimia, and it can also occur together with other eating disorders such as anorexia or binge eating, is exercising obsessively or too intensely or for too long. Or for an individual who is doing that and, you know, getting recurrent hypos.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Another thing may be a tendency towards always opting for the fat-free, the low-calorie meals. In women, we do also look for the absence of menstruation, but it's no longer a warning sign because eating disorders can occur in any size body.
So if our listeners are nodding their heads either about themselves or about someone that they know, what's the next step? How do you help, and what can we do?
So I think at least speaking to someone that you trust, whether it's a spouse, a partner, a doctor, a nurse, maybe just saying, you know, I'm not feeling comfortable about my relationship with food, or I'm noticing I'm having a lot of anxiety around food choices. You know, it's kind of just admitting that you're struggling. I think another aspect is if you are caring for someone with diabetes and you are seeing some warning signs, it's always important not to focus on looks. You know, I think I always say to parents, focus more on attributes and behavior and less about the look. Try to encourage family meals. As you mentioned early on, eating disorders are quite secretive. So again, if you are engaging in secret eating and hiding, and often that's where, you know, the binge eating is often done in secret and in hiding. And so
Yeah.
If you notice you're feeling uncomfortable eating in front of certain people, it might also be about having a conversation about, can you stop commenting about what and how much I'm eating at the table? You know, sometimes we avoid family meals because we worry someone at the table is the food police and probably going to hone in on what we are eating. And it does become very uncomfortable because as much as you want to just nourish your body, there is eating is not only about nutrition and nourishment. There is an element of pleasure and satisfaction. And sometimes eating becomes less joyous and it just becomes very regimental. So again, one could also comment and saying, I've noticed you skipping meals. Or for example, if it's a parent noticing a child, I'm trying to understand why we haven't needed to order more insulin. We seem to be having a lot of insulin still available. But again, eating disorders become very sneaky, and that is the sad part of it, is that people become experts at hiding. And sometimes our diabetes affords us this ability to hide because we can say, oh, my sugars were too high, and so that's why I missed the snack. Or, you know, so we sometimes blame our diabetes and the reason why we've got a poor relationship with food. At the beginning of last year, I started a group trying to network like-minded healthcare professionals into using non-diet approaches in practice, whether it's intuitive eating or mindful eating or other type of approaches, and it's called Non-Diet South Africa, and so that we can try and minimize things like weight bias and weight stigma in practice, and that we can afford people an alternative if we've reached the bottom and we just can't face the concept of another diet and more restriction, that there is a lot of other alternatives that are evidence-based, that still result in good diabetes care, good A1Cs. You can still have a healthy lifestyle.
Oh, what a relief.
Engage in positive movement and exercise that feels good for your body without always doing it because you feel you have to. So so good things are coming is what I would like to say. Yeah, but for those people who may have been triggered by some of this discussion, I would encourage you to reach out to any healthcare professional that you trust. And if you know that your healthcare provider is someone who always hones in on your weight or your body size, you have a choice and you can move, or you need to alert your doctor or healthcare provider that I'm finding every time you comment about my weight very hurtful and unhelpful.
So what we can offer at Sweet Life is just other people who feel the same way. So I think if you are really struggling with an eating disorder, it's important to get professional help and to reach out to a psychologist if you have one, or to a counselor or a diabetes nurse educator, or your doctor, as you said, if it's someone that you trust. But if you just need people to recognize that you're not in it alone, then that's what we can offer as a community. And I think what makes me the saddest about all of this is, as you said, the joy is often taken out of eating. Like, to me, food is one of the best things about life. I look forward to my next meal pretty much as soon as I've finished my last one. And it can still be joyful with diabetes once you've kind of found your groove and found your mojo and found what works for you. And also just how much of quality of life is leached out with eating disorders, right? If you're running yourself high on purpose, you're feeling terrible. Like, a day of high blood sugar is a bad day. It's just very difficult to enjoy anything if you're high, or if you're exercising a lot and having lots of hypos. Like, a day with a hypo is a difficult day. Like, it takes resilience to bounce back. And so I really want to encourage anyone listening who is struggling with this at the moment that it is possible to find, as you say, neutral. Isn't neutral such a beautiful word? Like, to find this neutral, happy space where you can eat food that you enjoy and not beat yourself up about it and feel well. Because that's also, like, food is about enjoyment and it's about feeling well. And it is possible to feel well with diabetes. It just takes the right team.
Absolutely. And I think certainly, like, with the intuitive eating, it could actually be another resource for people. There is a website, intuitiveeating.org. You could read the book.
I'd love to.
It really is about the process of learning to listen to your body and noticing how your body feels. Exactly like you said, you know, when your sugars are running high or running low, how are you experiencing that in your body? And recognizing that your body is an instrument. It's not an ornament.
Gail, thank you so much. This has been such a valuable and helpful discussion, and I really appreciate you bringing it out into the light.
Pleasure. Yeah, I think that's what I said at the beginning. I'm so grateful for the opportunity, because the more we talk about it, it just affords us access to care and just to bring it out in the open, and that there should be no shame in asking for help.
I also wanted to get the perspective of someone living with type 1 who's working through an eating disorder. So I've asked Ellery Clarence to join us. She's been living with type 1 diabetes since the age of 10 months and has a wealth of experience with pretty much every aspect of the condition. Ellery, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, Bridget. I feel very welcome, and thank you for inviting me to join you.
So you are in the process of recovering from an eating disorder with type 1 diabetes. What can you tell us? What is it like?
Well, yes, that's correct. I actually got diagnosed last year with an eating disorder, and I knew that I was struggling with one, but no doctor and no dietitian really put a point on it or a name on it. So when I was diagnosed then last year, I was like, oh my word, okay, someone saw me, someone understands, and now I can actually start working with it. Because, like, for example, in grade four, I stopped eating. I just told my parents, I'm not going to eat anymore. And they were freaking out because obviously I need to eat. So since last year, a lot has happened. I'm still recovering, but it felt so liberating to be diagnosed and have someone to work with and work through the process and the whole mental side and the mindset and everything. And it's unbelievable. I feel so, so much better. Yes, it's flipping hard work. I mean, I'm very focused on what I put in my mouth. We talk in our sessions about sober days.
Okay.
And I actually, because it's an addiction. I mean, she asked me, what is a sober day? And I said, well, that's if I have no Red Bull and chips and chocolates and stuff that I'm not supposed to have. But it's been now 26 days since I broke away from my eating plan. I feel so much better. And with the help and everything from everybody else, my body feels better. My sugar levels looks better. Yeah. My HbA1c is busy going down.
And also just to feel understood is so important,
definitely,
isn't it? Like, you're not just sitting in a room alone.
We determined that I am actually addicted to food. So it's not something specific, and that makes it a little bit more difficult because in my mind, I just eat to eat. And if I'm emotional or I'm stressed, obviously other people do that as well. But also sometimes I just mindlessly eat. Okay. As long as my mouth is moving, you know,
but you're not eating cucumber, are you? Because that's the thing. Hey, there's no fun in eating like a giant bowl of frozen peas. No one wants to do that. And who helped you with your diagnosis?
What happened is I've been working with my dietitian like since 2009, and it's been up and down. And then she told me about a lady that's in the same building as she is that specializes in eating disorders. It took me 2 years, but I went ahead and I made an appointment with Jeannie Maton. She's in Paul, and she's a clinical psychologist, and she has been, she's been working with me for the last year.
Well done, you. It's so hard also, because if you think about all the extra pressures that diabetes places on us already and all the other things we have to think about all the time already, and then to have to tackle something that is hard for anyone. Like, nobody is skipping into an office where they're dealing with an eating disorder, but you've already got diabetes and the rest of life. I'm so impressed. Well done.
It's been tough.
Yeah.
It's been really tough. But
and then
we are there.
You are doing so well. So what I find difficult about this, so this is a very fresh conversation for me too. Like, I don't think any of us have been talking about eating disorders or disordered eating and diabetes enough before, and I'm so grateful you were willing to talk to us today. What I find tricky is that we're kind of encouraged to have this necessary obsession with food and counting carbs and portion control and balancing insulin. So how do we manage to balance that with a healthy attitude towards eating?
Like I mentioned, it's really hard work. Oh, what I'm doing is I started exercising at the start of the year again because I haven't exercised for like 3 years. I had both my shoulders frozen up. So yeah, that as well. So what I did is I created a group with my friends. And they are kind of my accountability partners.
Yeah,
so
smart.
If I'm having a tough day or I'm really like I just want to eat and I don't really know what I want to eat or, you know, that whole mental struggle, I will check in with them and they do the same. If they have a trouble, and what's very great is that one of them is a diabetic as well.
Amazing.
So we check in and on each other. And I still see my psychologist once a month, and I still work with my dietitian. I mean, I can email her at any time and
ask her,
listen, I'm stuck here. And then, yeah, it's my husband plays a huge role. He helps me, he keeps me sane, if I can say it like that, around food. And I don't know, it's just something clicked at the beginning of the year, and I'm like, I need to change this because I feel so bad. I feel tired all the time, and my levels are all over the place. And I mean, walking into a shop now, it's not daunting anymore. Like, oh my word, look at all these chips and look at all these chocolates.
But amazing to have this team around you too. I think that's what's so healing about this, right? And what's so brave about you is that it's not that you've recognized that there's an issue and then you're just trying to soldier on alone. You've asked your friends to help. You've got your psychologist helping, your dietitian, your husband. Like, it's this whole team effort. I think it's wonderful. If anyone is listening and nodding their head or recognizing elements of their behavior here, so if they have diabetes and might be struggling with their eating, do you have any advice? What has helped you?
Okay, so as humans, we always want to help the people that we love, and we always want to force them into help. Like, don't do that, because that is what happened to me. I mean, my people love me, and they want to support me, and they want to do everything for me. But it makes it flippin' difficult because I was not right.
Yeah,
I was
not
mind,
ready.
The mindset was not there. So what I would say is, the person struggling needs to, like, admit and accept that they have a problem.
Yeah.
And when that happens, then you can step in and say, okay, let's look at what we can do for you. What is the options? Should you go see someone? Do you want to speak to someone? Do you want to speak to me or speak to a friend or whatever? But you can encourage them and listen. Sometimes we just need to vent. Sometimes, especially when it gets to a point where I can't handle it, I go to my husband or my sister and I tell her, I said, listen, I can't anymore. I don't want to, you don't necessarily have advice for me, or I don't necessarily want your advice. It's not to be rude or anything, but just listen so that we can get it out and get it out of our system and move on.
Yeah.
But when the point arrived, like with me, when I got to the point where I said, okay, I do have a problem and I need to accept that I have a problem. My husband was like with me 100%.
Yeah.
He's like, okay, I told him this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to see my dietitian. I'm going to make an appointment. I'm going to try my best. I'm going to look at what we eat and our budget and everything. And then we took it there from there as a team.
Yeah.
And what also helps a lot is if you know someone, try and get them involved in the community, especially like with a diabetes community or even an eating disorder community. Just get them involved there, because speaking to other people who can relate and
absolutely,
who can actually understand helps a lot.
Yeah.
And that's all the things that I got together, that I put together and to get where I am currently.
Wonderful.
So
Yeah. That makes so much sense. And also, I think what's so great about what you're saying is that it's not that we as people with diabetes need someone to swoop in and save us. It's that when we're ready to take the next step, then we just want our people to support us, but that next step is up to us. Oh, that's such good advice. Thank you. And last question, what makes your life sweet?
what makes my life sweet is I still have my parents. Both of my parents are still alive. I have my sister. My husband is a darling and I love him so much. And going on adventures with him is what I live for these days because we have so much fun. And being part of the diabetic community, absolutely, that saved me in a lot of ways. Having coffee every day, you can take my chocolate away, but please don't take my coffee away because that's the sweetest thing. That's the sweetest thing. And then last thing, I'm reading. I know people are like, you read? I'm like, yes, I read.
Oh, God, I read. It's the one thing I do. It's the one thing I always have time for.
It actually saved me a few years back. So,
That makes perfect sense.
That is what makes my life. And, and cats. Cats make my life sweet.
It sounds like such a sweet life. Thank you so much, Ollie. Thank you for joining us. And thank you so much for sharing your experience because I think this is what we need, right? We need to just be normalizing this and talking about it and recognizing that these crazy thoughts that we all have in some degree in our heads are not actually that crazy because we all have them. It's so important. Thank you. If anyone is listening and struggling with an eating disorder and diabetes, please remember you're not alone. You can reach out for help either to us, to the online diabetes community, or to a friend or family member or your doctor or your psychologist or your dietitian. There are so many people all ready and willing and waiting to help. And then there was one. Please join us next week for the final episode in this season. We'll be chatting to Dr. Sandy Bruder about the root cause of diabetes. It is sure to be an enlightening discussion. Please join us. I want to thank you for taking the time to listen today and invite you to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. It's such a pleasure to be able to spend this time with you and I really appreciate it. I'm sure your diabetes management appreciates it too. Big thanks to Lilly for sponsoring this season of South Africans with Diabetes. Lilly is the leading provider of insulin in South Africa, supporting people with diabetes through high-quality, affordable products. Lilly unites caring with discovery to create medicines that make life better for people around the world. This podcast comes to you from Sweet Life Diabetes Community. We are South Africa's largest online diabetes community, a space to connect with other people living with diabetes, share tips, and offer advice. Our website, sweetlife.org.za, has all the diabetes info you need, all in one place. We're like the diabetes Wikipedia of South Africa. We offer expert advice that's easy to understand and written just for you. Whether you're looking for the latest news and updates on diabetes in South Africa, tips to manage your condition better, meal plans and diabetes-friendly recipes, exercise suggestions, or how to lose weight, we have an expert answer for you. We also have free ebooks to download, a diabetes cookbook, diabetes guidebook, and a healthy food guide. Most importantly, we have a community of people with diabetes who understand what it's like to live with the condition every day. We're all in this together.